I call the Health and Social Services Committee to order at 1:34 p.m. on Wednesday, March 7th. We're meeting today in room 205 in the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phone as a courtesy. Committee members present today are Senator Michicki, Senator Begich, myself, Senator Wilson. We are expecting Senator Von Imhoff, and Senator DeGiesel is on other state bill. And Senator Von Imhoff just joined us, and Senator DeGiesel should be joining us later. She's presenting another bill in another committee. Today we are going to hear from the governor's appointees to the Alaska Mental Health Board of Trustees. Following that, we'll hear a presentation from the Director of Office of Children's Services, Chrissy Lawton, and we'll provide a response to the Citizens Review Panel presentation we heard on February 26th. And lastly, we'll return to Senate Bill 169, Medicaid Behavioral Health Coverage, by Senator Geisel. For consideration today for our governor appointees, first we'll invite Ms. Vernay Berner of Anchorage, if she can introduce herself and speak to her qualifications and answer any questions from the committee. And then we'll hear from Mike Powers after we hear from Ms. Vernay. Vernay, are you with us today on the phone?
Yes, I am. And for the record, my name is Vernay Berner. First name, and for the benefit of folks, is pronounced Vernay, rhymes with Renee. And last name Berner, like a stove burner. Would you like me to just jump in?
Yes, please.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name again is Vernay Berner. My Inupiaq name is Kanak, after my grandmother. I'm an enrolled tribal member of the sovereign Native village of Kayana. I am very honored to be here with you today and to share with you my experience and interest in serving as a trustee for the Mental Health Trust Authority. I would like to go ahead and start by sharing my earliest memory. That's when I was 4 years old. I believed I was driving, but I wasn't really. Now go to the Armory for the Head Start in Kayana. Kayana is my hometown, where my grandmother and Athene, our namesake, served as one of the first generation community health aides. She was my first exposure to tribal health, and back then patients often came to our home for care. We did not have a toilet, and I remember having to scamper in the middle of winter to the outhouse with all the scary stories of the Inupiaqs and Nakaks that my aunts and uncles used to tease me with. By the way, it's truly amazing to me that there are so many homes in Kayana today that do not have water and sewer hookups. But by the time I graduated from our tribal leaders, working with our elders, created the Inupiaq Ilocosait, which is a collection of Inupiaq values that are not exclusive to our people, and in fact are shared by many tribal people in Alaska, across the United States, and many indigenous cultures. But the premise of the Inupiaq Ilocosait is that every Inupiaq person is responsible to all other Inupiaq for the survival of our cultural spirit and the values and traditions through which it survives. It is through our extended family we retain, teach, and live our Inupiaq way of life. With guidance and support from our elders, we teach our children our Inupiaq Ilocosait values, and there's a list of 17 values that go with this. These were my formative experiences, and this is the briefest way that I can think of introducing you to who I am and the foundational experiences that I bring to the table. My specific interest in the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority comes from the tribes and tribal leaders. I'm the president and CEO of the Alaska Native Health Board. ANHB is a statewide voice on Alaska Native health issues, and it is in its 50th year as an advocacy organization for the health needs and concerns of all Alaska Native people. And its mission is to promote the spiritual, physical, mental, social, and cultural well-being and pride of Alaska Native people. Since my returning to Alaska and prior to that, our leadership has stated that the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority Board of Trustees needs representation from those familiar with the Alaska tribal health system. particularly considering the overrepresentation of our people as trustee beneficiaries. The Alaska Tribal Health System is a true system of care with voluntary participation of sovereign tribes and tribal health organizations through a single negotiated compact with the federal government. The Alaska Tribal Health System provides health services for Alaskan Natives and American Indians in over 200 facilities and locations across the entire state. The ATHS provides health care in every Alaskan community and is a critical component of the Alaska Public Health System. I come before you today with the encouragement and blessing of the Alaska Native Health Board. As far as my experience goes, I have over 20 years of experience in tribal health, health promotion, disease prevention, administration, and budgeting experience, and I have served tribes in the establishment and formation of tribal epidemiology centers and have over 13 years of experience serving on a tribal institutional review board working on human protection issues with particular attention to the vulnerable populations such as those who comprise the beneficiaries of the Alaska Mental Health Trust. I am also a Native American Research Centers on Health Fellow and hold a master's degree in public health and an undergraduate degree in business administration. My passion is addressing health disparities in indigenous and minority populations through health research, policy development, education, and outreach. I am a firm believer in community-based approaches to best tap the existing strengths and resources of these resilient populations in order to address health disparities. I have observed that culturally intelligent approaches are needed to build and build upon evidence-based approaches in interventions, outreach, and treatment. I've had the honor of being entrusted by tribes to represent them on health issues from the state and national levels, including complex work groups such as the Restructuring Initiative of the Indian Health Service and the National IHS Budget Formulation Work Group, as well as serving on translational research into practice advisory groups. In my earlier presentation, I was also asked to provide information on my experience with finance and land issues, and I just wanted to share with you all that in my role as administrative officer at the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board, I oversaw grant and contract management as well as fiscal management in accordance with OMB circulars and the Single Audit Act, monitoring budgets as well as contract and grant reporting requirements. I was also the lead contact for our annual audit and was responsible for negotiating lease and contract agreements and held responsibilities and authority for investment strategies for the 98-638 funds that the tribes received and negotiations with the bank. I also served as MPIHB's representative to the Portland Area's Facility Advisory Board, which reviewed construction and renovation projects of facilities and sanitation systems for the then 43 recognized, federally recognized tribes in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. I also offer one other sort of unique perspective regarding Alaska's diversity and immigrant population. I consider myself to have three citizenships. I am a citizen of the Native village of Kayana, I'm a United States citizen, and I am a naturalized citizen of Germany. Alaska has grown in so many ways in our lifetimes, and even in our small village of Kayana, we have naturalized citizens from around the world. I know what it is like to go through that process and to seek health care and mental health services in a foreign country with limited command of the language. Naturalized families experience unique health issues and concerns of which I have not only learned about academically, but have personally experienced. And in closing, I'd like to just offer my personal interest for serving. Like all of the trustees, I have a very personal drive for wishing to serve as a trustee. I hope to honor my late sister. She lost her battle with alcohol 3 days before her 29th birthday. She was trying to quit and had no other drugs in her system. The coroner's report listed her cause of death as natural due to complications of chronic ethanolism. and I pose that there is nothing natural about the death of a 29-year-old. I'm very honored to be with you today, and thank you for your time and consideration, and welcome your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Berner. Are there questions from committee members at this time for Ms. Berner?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you for being here, Ms. Berner. Two of us were in finance earlier, so I know the two of us signed the document for moving you on, but I had my questions answered, and I'm very, very glad to have you interested in being on the Mental Health Trust Authority Board.
Thank you so much.
Ms. Berner, I do have a question upon your previous chairship of organization, the Alaska Native Health Board. Do they do receive money from the Mental Health Trust?
No, that is an excellent question. In fact, we do not. We do not receive any dollars from the Alaska Mental Health Trust. Certainly not within the last 2 years and not in any time since I've been here, and I've been here since 2013.
Okay. Thank you.
I had the same question.
Okay. All right. Seeing that, thank you, Ms. Berner. There's no other further questions. Do you have any other closing comments?
No, just that I appreciate your time and your consideration, and hope to be able to serve. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we'll go to Mike Powers. Mike, if you can state your name for the record.
Yes, this is Mike Powers, P-O-W-E-R-S, Fairbanks, Alaska.
If you could introduce, if you could speak to your qualifications and...
Very good. First of all, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the Senate Health Committee. Mike Powers, I'm applying for a position on the Mental Health Trust Authority Board, Board of Trustees. I'm a 34-year resident of Alaska. Came to Alaska in 1981 and was here for 2 years as first as a VISTA volunteer and then as a writer for a small newspaper, the Senior Voice newspaper. I returned to Wisconsin and Virginia to pursue a master's degree in health services administration fellowship in Virginia, and then returned to Alaska immediately and this time to Fairbanks. I was the chief financial officer at Fairbanks Memorial Hospital for 10 years, and then I stepped into the CEO role for the past 20 years. When I finished that and retired, I happened to be on the Board of Regents for the University of Alaska. Chancellor Brian Rogers was stepping down at that point. It was late in the spring, not enough time to appoint a committee to begin the national search, and so I served as interim chancellor at UAF for the 2015-16 academic year. I returned to the Tanana Valley Clinic here in Fairbanks, large multi-specialty clinic, last spring. I'm interested in the Mental Health Trust for several reasons. As CEO at Fairbanks Memorial over the years and as CEO now, much of my time was focused and is currently focused on building programs, recruiting personnel related to behavioral health issues. We just stepped out of a foundation meeting here, a board meeting here, and the entire behavioral health question is described often as a crisis in Fairbanks, in Alaska, and frankly, nationally. Much of my time in building those programs and recruiting personnel to support those programs dealt with our emergency department, our 20-bed behavioral health unit with 4 secure beds, relationships with the court system, downtown businesses, police, support agencies, family members who would come looking for support in ways we might be able to help their situations. In my own family, I have a 23-year-old developmentally disabled niece, and in the recent months I've been helping my brother as he attempts to rally support for housing needs for this for his daughter, and just how to go about addressing this, as I say, national crisis in many respects. I believe, after looking back on 30 some years in various health capacities in the interior, two exceptionally vulnerable populations that are very dear to me. One is our seniors, and I've had considerable experience at our skilled long-term care nursing facility, Denali Center, as the CEO, as oversaw that operation as well. And secondly, mentally ill and developmentally disabled individuals, highly vulnerable, and it's a interest of mine to help address these needs in our community and across the state. That's really what prompts my interest in the Mental Health Trust Authority. In a nutshell, that is why I am interested. This morning in Senate Finance, though, I want to mention an issue arose which I was not aware of regarding prohibitions on appointments. I served as interim chancellor, as I mentioned, that 15-16 academic year, and there's a two-year time frame for appointments by entities receiving mental health trust income. I'm not aware of trust funds, but it certainly could have been an issue coming into the organization, $450 million organization like the university. And I understand Senate Finance is pursuing a legal review of that situation, and I just want to point that out and extend my appreciation for the Senate looking into that issue.
Thank you. Senator Baggage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just very quickly, when did you complete your time there at the university as the interim chancellor?
August. I stepped on August of 2016.
Okay, thank you. That was the only question I had.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Powers at this time? Senator Machiki?
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman. I would have been very supportive and would have signed the form this morning, and will do so once, just speaking from Senate Finance, once we have that ruling, if it turns out to be favorable, I would certainly be willing to do that. I'm glad that he has applied, but we can share that ruling from Ledge Legal when we have it available with your office as well.
Thank you. All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Powers. And with that, we are aware of that uncertainty, and so we're going to hold that appointment at this time. But we just wanted to make sure we had an opportunity to interview you and not to have you to come back at a later date if everything comes out okay through that finding. So at this time, we'll go ahead. And do you have any other questions or any other comments, Mr. Powers?
No, just very much appreciate your service, and I understand the situation.
Thank you, sir. And thank you for both you and Ms. Bernard's availability to put your names forth and to serve the state in this capacity. At this time, we'll go ahead and open up to public testimony on the governor's appointees. Is there anyone here in Juneau wish to testify for either Ms. Berner or for Mr. Powers? Seeing or hearing none and seeing or no one else online, we'll go ahead and close public testimony. Well, now, Senator, is there a motion to advance Ms. Berner's appointee from the committee report from this committee?
Yes.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I move the appointment of Vernay Berner to the Mental Health Trust Authority Board of Trustees to be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. This does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individual during any further sessions.
Right. Thank you. Is there an objection? Hearing or seeing none, we'll take an at-ease to sign the document, and we'll ask Director Lawton to come forth to get ready for a presentation. We'll go back on the record. Next before us is Department of Health and Social Services, Office of Children's Services, Director Christy Lawton, regarding the Citizens Review Panel that this committee heard on February 26th. Also on the phone for any questions, only to answer questions, as Dr. D. Walker-Valapalli is also online for any clarifying questions or comments if committee members need to refresher from that presentation. You may begin when ready.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Christy Lawton, Director of the Office of Children's Services. It's great to be back in Senate Hess. Today I am going to address some of the recommendations and hear your questions following Dr. Vandapalli's presentation last week. I also am going to just provide some additional information after speaking with Senator Wilson that I thought might be relevant related to some of the challenges that we're facing at OWCS, as well as some of the strategies that we're working on to seek solutions. So I'm going to start there and lay the foundation with some data, and I've left the CRP recommendations and discussion towards the latter half. But I will move quickly since I know we have limited time. Some of you have already seen this slide, I think, in other presentations, but this slide really depicts the growth in the number of protective services reports our agency has received over the last 6 years. You can see between calendar year 16 and calendar year 17, we've had a significant increase in the number of reports. It's jumped up 16% between those 2 years, which is giving us concern in terms of what might happen next year, because we haven't done anything different in terms of encouraging more reports. We haven't done any additional outreach per se. We haven't done any additional trainings, and so we're left with wondering, why are we seeing such a huge spike in the number of reports? I believe that it's in large part reflective of what's happening in our communities, but only time will tell. But with a higher increase of reports coming in, that means a higher proportion of those reports will likely get screened in for an investigation, and a proportion of those will then ultimately likely lead to more formal services through foster care. I think the other point that I like to make on this slide is that of the 20,000 reports we received in calendar year 2017, typically about 70% of those reports are received by mandated reporters, so those that are required by law to report, not just the average neighbor or citizen. The other 30% comes from citizens, relatives perhaps, or other people that are just worried about a child. We receive the most number of reports with allegations of neglect, which is a broad category that can encompass things around supervision, parent substance abusing activities that are interfering with their ability to safely care. Second, mental injury is right up there after neglect, which really is reflective of the issues of domestic violence that we see in our state. Third is physical abuse, and the fewest reports we receive is around child sexual abuse. This slide helps you see kind of the trajectory of the numbers of kids in out-of-home care and how that has grown over the last 10 years. The numbers on the graph are the total numbers of children that were in foster care for at least one day during that year. So if you were listening to a presentation I gave in Senate Finance HSS Subcommittee last night, the point-in-time number I said for December 31st, 2017 was significantly less than that 4,200 you see up there at the top, and that's because that was a point-in-time number versus when we look at all the children that enter and exit foster care during the entire calendar year, it's much more children, and is a more accurate depiction of the volume of children we're serving, which relates to the costs it requires us to serve or to fund the services that we're paying for them. I think the other thing just to note, you can see by the way that graphic goes, but from 2011 to 2016, we had a 54% growth in the number of children in out-of-home care, which is significant. We've analyzed this over the years, had lots of conversations, and really it comes down to multiple factors for that growth. One of the issues is certainly the opioid epidemic in Alaska and some of the other challenges our communities face. We also know that in around 2010, we had started to look at our processes around intake and recognize that despite the fact that the national average for screening in reports that states receive was about 65%, Alaska was screening out about 65%. So we were sort of total opposite from the rest of the country, and as such, we were seeing an increased rate of repeat maltreatment to children because we simply were not going out and trying to offer services in enough cases as we should have. And so we did make some policy and practice decisions such that we are giving a closer eye to families so that we can prevent them from coming back through the front door over and over again. I wanted to talk a little bit about the elephant in the room for us is always workforce challenges that we have, which drives almost all of the outcomes that we struggle to keep at the rate that we're expected to. Case-carrying workers turn over almost at a 50% rate for 2017, and it was about 49% of those caseworkers during that year ended up leaving and leaving their job as a caseworker. Some of those may have been promoted, but many of them simply left the agency because the job was not doable and it didn't meet their expectations in terms of their desire to truly help kids and families. We also struggle with having a staff population that matches the population we serve, particularly in our outlying smaller community offices. We really struggle to get local people to apply for our positions. So as a result, you all find often that those positions are filled by people that have moved to Alaska from out of state because the pay looks so desirable when they go online because of the cost of living adjustments. Unfortunately, those people aren't generally prepared or really realistic about what they'll expect to see and how life in Alaska will be, and many of them don't stay long, or they look to transfer into a large urban area as soon as possible. So that sort of constant churn of workforce, every time a worker turns over, you can expect that it'll take an additional 6 to 8 more months to allow that child to get to permanency, whether that be reunification or to guardianship or adoption, because it just takes a long time to get somebody up to speed and to balance the work on those cases. I think the other impacts that we talked about is that if with the worker turnover, what we also see is that it impacts our rate of reentry. So children are more likely to reenter foster care if they have had a number of different caseworkers, because the quality of services and the quality of that relationship certainly diminishes over time. There's also worker safety issues. You might be aware, I'm sure you're aware, that the governor has an amended budget that includes some funds for OCS for a full-time statewide safety officer, as well as 2 full-time security officers in our Kenai and Fairbanks offices. If those funds are approved, that will make a total of 5 security officers, or I'm sorry, 6 security officers we have statewide. We have 2 in Anchorage, 1 in Juneau, and 1 in Wasilla right now. And it gives me a great deal of heartburn, to be honest with you, to be a helping family-orientated agency where we are putting security at the front door that really is not how we want to have people enter, but worker safety really does have to come first, and it's come to the point where if we don't do something, something's going to happen and we're going to regret that we didn't do everything we could to keep our employees safe. So despite that, we are going to try to make those environments still as supportive and non-threatening as we can, and we've been successful in doing that in the areas that we have guards now. It's not all doom and gloom around workforce. I'm really pleased to tell you about some new efforts that we have underway with the University of Alaska Anchorage and the University of Alaska Fairbanks. This summer, a new director of the School of Social Work at UAA came on board from Oklahoma, and within literally weeks of him coming on board, we were having meetings about how he could help us with the workforce challenges in child welfare. He came from a state that they had some really good collaborations with their public child welfare agency, where they also were really creative in drawing down federal 4E dollars to help fund some of those programs. And so we are meeting monthly to look at how we can create an interdisciplinary child welfare certificate track. We want to resurrect and create a more robust stipend program to encourage both BSW or MSW employees or degree-seeking employees to go back to school if they choose to, with some support from OCS. We also are looking at how we can beef up recruitment efforts for people interested in child welfare, not just within the School of Social Work, but in other degree programs where there's people that are in the helping arena and we think could be qualified and would make a good match for the Office of Children's Services. We've also, in the last 5 years, been working with the Leadership Academy, with the National Child Welfare Workforce Institute, a national organization, and we've been engaging with them in some tools that they offer, particularly the Leadership Academy for Middle Managers, which really gets at our middle management around the state, as well as supervisors and others. They have an online training, and our staff have also benefited from in-person training. And we have a number of goals that are being worked on right now that will create competency-based evaluations so that when new employees leave the classroom setting following their 3 to 5 weeks of training, they will be asked to do some testing so we can evaluate their competency. And if it looks like they missed the boat in some key areas, we'll have a chance to work with them. Instead, right now, we don't do any sort of testing, and we find out once they're out practicing in the field, and by then it's a little late. It's harder to slow the train down once they're out there with cases. So this will give us an opportunity to really further vet our employees and make sure that they're as prepared as they need to.
Two questions.
Mm-hmm.
I have a quick question for your turnover rate. What's your current or your current most recent turnover rate for the time periods?
For 2017, it was 49%, and we looked at all of the case-carrying workers. So it's not the most scientific method, I'll tell you. We look at it a number of different ways. But for 2017, all of our employees that are case-carrying have to go through the Child Welfare Academy that trains them. And so we look at their data in terms of the number of unique employees that went through there, and then we compare that to the number of positions per region, and it came out at 49% statewide of those employees exited.
Thank you. Senator mm-hmm. Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Lawton, just on the UAA-UAF collaborative goals, I believe that actually dovetails with the problems on page 4. And my wife loves when I talk about the fact that I married a North Roader. I married someone from Nikiski, Alaska. A lot of my buddies had married folks from somewhere else. Sounded like a great idea. And after a few years, didn't necessarily fit our lifestyle or more difficult way of living, if you will. So just considering some of the challenges in the rural and Alaska Native communities. Have we done any outreach with Native corporations to see if they would assist on scholarship programs for having people from that are difficult to replace, mm-hmm. culturally, socially, and as you've admitted, it's difficult to retain folks from somewhere else in some of those communities, but is that something that you've had some outreach to Native corporations to create scholarship programs for the child welfare certificate programs that would be a better fit?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I haven't done any direct outreach, but I can tell you there has been conversations. I met several months ago with Bob Andor, who's the, I forget his title, but he's at the Tribal College, and talked about how we might build a partner in terms of what they're doing, what our workforce needs are. I also just met recently with Jeff Jesse, who's the dean for the College of Health at UAA, around this collaborative idea that we're doing with the social work program, and he had a number of ideas as we talked about, you know, what's coming down the road with the Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Compact, and you know, if tribes are going to start taking over more services in terms of the child welfare arena, they likely will have a need for some workforce development in their areas too. And so he had a number of ideas, and we talked at a very high level of, gosh, wouldn't it be great to get a convening together to sort of get people around health and child welfare and the people that are helping to educate them and get everybody in the same room to see how we can help one another, because there are a lot of workforce needs, particularly in the health industry, but also in child welfare. So not particularly to the I forget the word you just used a minute ago, to the doyens and to the those organizations, but we have been having conversations at a lawyer level.
Just brief follow-up, just adds a third win to the win-win of the Alaska Tribal Welfare Compact, I believe. So it's something worthy of consideration in these tough times of funding. You don't have the excess funding. The university doesn't have the excess funding, and maybe a worthwhile outreach. Thank you.
Thank you.
I did just want to, in the vein of challenges and solutions, I wanted to just touch base to review that in May of 2017, OCS did undergo what's called the third round Child and Family Services Review, so a federal review. All states are going through this review, and this is the third time that the federal government has done such a review. They went to three areas in Alaska, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Ketchikan. Did random sampling of cases. You can find the full report at the link provided there, or just go to the OCS website. We did not achieve national performance in the areas of safety, permanence, and well-being, which to achieve it, you have to hit the 95% mark, which is a very high mark for states to meet, as it should be, since we're talking about kids. We did have some areas of strength, particularly around the stability of the foster care placements. We also do a pretty good job of keeping siblings together whenever we can, and we also are really good at ensuring children have their educational needs met. And I will say that's really kudos to our caregivers, our foster parents and relatives, because they're the ones that are really ensuring that children are getting their educational needs met and alerting us when there's a gap. The areas where we did the poorest was around ensuring providing ways to keep children in their homes so they don't have to be removed, finding ways to wrap services around them with a safety plan to prevent removal. That's definitely a challenge for us. Also having children have permanency and stability in all their living situations, that's a challenge for us. We also struggle to have families have the services they need to enhance their capacities to safely care for their children. And caseworker visits with parents and also with children is a huge growth area for us. We do pretty good at getting visits to see the children. That's the ones that we prioritize for obvious reasons. It's important for us to see them every month to know that they're being well cared for and that they're safe. It's much more difficult for our caseworkers to see monthly the parents, and so that's going to be a huge area of a huge focus area of our performance improvement plan, because if we don't see the parents frequently and have the kinds of conversations about their progress on their case plan and what they need, then they're less likely to be successful. So those are challenges, and with our geographic areas in Alaska, it provides lots of unique opportunities to be creative how to do that, and that's also something that I think the compact will help with in terms of creating those opportunities for tribes to help us have those face-to-face visits where they're located, where OCS is not.
Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Lawton, on this maybe ties right into your strengths discussion right now, but you mentioned in the out-of-home care that you had an increase of 54% over that period of time, mm-hmm. Where it spikes up. Has the growth in foster homes remained static, or has it paralleled that increase, or how is it matching that increase in the number of kids that are being placed out of home?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, we have obviously licensed more homes during that time, but the biggest focus has been to get more kids in with relatives. So we haven't seen, you won't see a 50% increase in the number of licensed foster homes that match that number. They have grown, not at the rate that we need. We're still really at a point, if I'm understanding your question, we're still really at a point where we have homes, but we don't have enough homes such that we have the luxury to really evaluate child A, and here we've got five foster homes that have vacancies and match the child to the parents and what their skills and abilities they have. We often are in a position where we have one child and we simply only have one home with one bed. And so we'd like to get to a point where we have far more homes than we need so that we can do better matching to placement.
That was precisely the question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Machiki.
No, I wish I had. So I was invited to the meeting on during the review, and I wish I had my notes with it. It there were two things that I took away from it. One was that we had some challenges in the state of Alaska and the Office of and OCS. But the other that I brought away from it was that it seemed like there are very few states that were at the 95% standard, which led me to believe that perhaps the expectations were somewhat unrealistic. So it's possible that we could be penalized at some point. Is that correct? If we don't raise our standards, do you feel that the national performance standards are a realistic measure of where a program should be? For the first question,
Through the chair, Senator Mushicki, I think that the national standards are where they are. Because of what we expect a child and a family should be entitled to receive. I mean, when a state does a very intrusive act and it's not voluntary in nature that forces a family apart to try to get them well, and a child is being cared for by people that may not be their relatives or someone that knows them, I think the expectations should be exceedingly high. Is it realistic, given the state of public child welfare funding across the country and the challenges that states are dealing with the opioid crisis and other things, and not having the resources to really invest in those families, to think that we can achieve that with the infrastructure and the systems we have? I don't think that's so realistic, but I think that those goals are certainly what they should be.
Actually, that she answered both questions without me asking the second one, so thank you for that.
Okay, so moving on, this is about, so we have the CFSR, we've got lots of areas needing improvement. So what's going to happen now over the next year is we will be negotiating with our partners at Region 10 to identify the strategies that we will use to improve outcomes, particularly the outcomes where we fared the worst. This is an ongoing kind of back and forth negotiation process. We just received back yesterday a first rounds of comments from Region 10 about what they liked of our first draft, what they didn't like in our first draft. They thought we were trying to do too much, and that was unrealistic. So now we'll have 30 days to sort of take their feedback and to rethink kind of the preliminary plan. We also intend to have some additional stakeholder meetings to bring back some of the people that we talked to early on, to let them see kind of how the PIP was involved. And what will happen is once we agree on the final plan that the state then is obligated to work over the period of 2 years, is there'll be benchmarks set for each of these areas. So if we were at 25%, let's say, in caseworker visits with parents, we may set a goal of we want to get in within 2 years. Now, just 2 years, it's not that we don't want to move that goal higher after that, but we might negotiate that within 2 years we want to see 50%, that 50% of all the parents are seen every month per policy. If at the end of that PIP we do not meet those negotiated goals, there is a possibility that they would extend the PIP for another year. But there's also the possibility, if they think the state hasn't made enough efforts and has not made enough progress, there is the remote possibility. Well, I shouldn't say remote. There is the distinct possibility of financial penalties to the state. Having gone through this process two prior times since I've worked for the agency, we've not been penalized before. Everybody has worked as hard as they can, and we have been able to successfully complete the PIP and get to those measures that we need to. But the financial penalties is always a possibility. So the program improvement plan is really going to focus on three primary areas around safety. And safety, obviously, is something that we're looking at throughout the entire life of a case, not just at the point of intake or the point of investigation, but safety while children are in out-of-home placements. But safety at the beginning, and our ability to assess children and families when we're out there in their homes with very little information about a concern, is definitely one of the biggest key decision points that we have, and we've got some improvement to do in terms of the timeliness of some of that work and the safety planning that we do thereafter. We also know that key to success of any of our families really comes down to basic human engagement of how well our caseworkers can have a relationship with their families and connect in a way that there is some semblance of trust, and so that the worker and the parent can work collaboratively, and that the parent really sees that person as a resource and as someone that's trying to help them versus someone that's trying to catch them doing wrong. So we have a lot of work to do to work on really increasing engagement throughout our process and improving that, and really looking to how we can help parents increase their protective capacities so that they can get their children back. One of the other big things we intend to do through this PIP that we are lacking right now in Alaska is we have some really great quality assurance mechanisms in place. We have a whole quality assurance unit that does case reviews for us, pumps out reports. In fact, the feds always use Alaska as an example for other states of the great work of our quality assurance unit. We every year go up through a process whereby we use the federal instrument, the Child and Family Services Review Instrument, and our unit reviews those cases just like the feds were, so we can continually give ourselves data about what we're doing well, what we're still struggling with. What we don't have, what we're still missing, is a real CQI process that sort of, you know, kind of goes along the entire continuum and completes the circle. So when a QA report is completed and that information gets handed to me, and then I talk to, say, regional management, and I say, okay, you know, for Anchorage, here's the areas where you guys were really struggling with, and they go, okay, well, we've got some ideas of how we can improve that. That's great, but we don't have a way to sort of close the loop to really follow through to see if then did those activities improve it, and if they don't improve it, do we need to create another strategy? So we have some things that we need to do to make it more solid, continuous quality improvement, which will affect everything we do statewide. I did just want to touch on, because Senator Von Imhoff had questions last time I was here about the legislative audit, HB 30 from 2013. There were several recommendations specific to OCS that you can see on the slide there, specific to separating out the foster care licensing and regulations from other residential care facilities. That work is almost done. The regulations were drafted. They're actually out for public comment right now through April 6th. So once that process is done, those will be entirely separated. The other big recommendation was around developing the template or checklist for OCS workers or ETs to assist in correctly documenting the components of the Title IV eligibility within appropriate time frames, and that was completed. So those were the two things that primarily came out of that audit, and After that audit, we took time to not only look at their recommendations, but some other things that we learned, and we've made a number of adjustments to how we are looking at our claiming, and we've made improvements such that our federal 4E penetration rate has significantly improved since then, and we've just continued to make strides forward. So we have actually begun to be at a point where our GF was almost neutral because of the gains of our federal dollars. So I just wanted to follow back up on that.
If we could take a brief at ease. Director Lawton, I was trying to find the part of the audit, and my understanding was that DHS conducts licensing in five different divisions. Instead of doing all five, so separating one out, that I thought the recommendation was more to combine some of those licensing functions so that travel to some of the same homes doesn't have to happen by different divisions, but can actually happen by one division and not separating it out to its own separate division.
Mr. Chairman, there may have been discussion through conversations in their stakeholder interviews, but the recommendation, as I understood it, at the end of the day was that we separate foster care licensing statutes and regulations from other residential care facilities, because residential care facilities have more sort of rigid requirements that the average family foster home doesn't need, and so it was impeding our ability to get our family foster homes fully licensed, which reduced the amount of federal dollars we could get. So I'm not sure about the conversation about trying to have a unified approach to licensing visits.
Okay, yes, you're right. There we go. That licensing care homes should remain a separate function because it was closely integrated with the field work. So we're good.
Okay.
I do have a follow-up question.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So, Director Lawton, I know, and I've heard this comment before in other presentations, both in Senate Finance and in here, all within DHSS, in regards to pointing out that UGF amounts this year are actually less than a few years ago, which is noteworthy in light that the number of recipients in Medicaid and in OCS have increased. While that statement is true, when you factor in the supplemental that is out there right now for 2018, that in fact tips the scales a bit in a much higher UGF. So that is an important caveat to include in the conversation. And when looking in 2019 and in the future, one can speculate with when you looked at your one of your first few slides to see a significant jump in children served in your particular department, as well as we've seen in other departments as well. One can speculate that in 2019 and beyond, the pressure on UGF may in fact be a great deal, especially if many of these additional people served are not in the expansion population being served at the 90-10 split with the federal government, but more in a 50-50 split. So I just want to state for the record that it's an interesting to note the UGF decline, or I guess static for the last few years, when not factoring the supplemental. And I am curious to see what future years may hold when you consider the sum of all the different presentations we've been having as of late about the incredible jump of participants in Medicaid. Thank you.
May I respond?
Yes, please.
So last night when we did a presentation to the Senate HES Finance Subcommittee, we did have a slide that I have here that you don't have, but that really looked at the budget changes from FY 2015 to FY 2019 that as I understand it, did include the supplemental request. And for OCS, the decrease in UGF was $89,000. I can't speak to the other departments, but we attribute that to our increased the various things that we have done to really maximize the federal revenue that we're drawing down. Will that hold come next year? I'm not sure, but for this year, it is a reduction.
Thank you. That is a fair statement, and I understand that, and I appreciate the clarification. There is also, will it hold? I guess that's the question. Will it hold to the future remains to be seen, and I guess we'll let that develop as time marches on.
Thank you. I also want to welcome Senator Giesel to committee. Please continue, Director Lawton.
I wanted to just touch on a few successes and some 2018 priorities. I won't go into too much further about the Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Compact since we did that not too long ago. I did want to note that we continue to see that our efforts to safely discharge children from foster care is working. We actually have started to exceed our exits are now exceeding our entries, which is great. For a number of years, we had way more kids coming in than we were able to safely exit out the back door. That now is sort of turning tides and is going the other way. We've also seen our repeat maltreatment rate has significantly dropped, and that goes back to some of the things I mentioned earlier about some policy decisions we made, that we are going out and looking at some of these cases, and consequently, some of these kids are not getting re-referred. They're not coming back in and having another substantiated report, so that's a good thing. We are working, as I said a minute ago, to finalize and implement the program improvement plan. We also have been doing some really exciting work around centralization of our intake services. So intake is the place that you call or you fax or you show up and walk into if you need to make a report about a child that may be experiencing maltreatment. In the previous history, we had intake workers sitting in all 23 of our offices, taking reports, taking walk-ins with supervisors in various locations, and we had pretty inconsistent practices from region to region and even office to office. So over the last 5 years, we've been moving in the direction of centralized intake, which will enable us to be far more responsive to the community. And hopefully within the next year, we'll also be able to go to a 24/7 hotline system like many other states have, so that any time of day you can reach an intake professional at the Office of Children's Services and take their report. Right now, if it's a call comes in between the hours of 12 and 7 a.m., we have an answering service that, you know, makes some decisions about who's calling and what's happening, and they make a decision as to whether to refer to law enforcement or to contact an on-call social worker. And while they've done a good job for us, we feel like we really need to have intake professionals making those decisions, so it'll be better responsiveness to the community, and ultimately we'll be able to get to children sooner so that children are safe. And then, of course, I already talked a little bit about the continued efforts to work on workforce issues and really our efforts to look at how we're even interviewing and what are the qualities we're looking for of employees as they come in the front door, so that we can best find people matched for the work and they really understand what they're getting into, because we think they'd be more likely to stay if that were the case.
A couple questions, Director Lawton. First one is your centralized intake practices. Do you feel that maybe that's more of a correlation between what you presented on slide 2, sort of your 17 uptakes and ticks between when OCS sort of moved to that more centralized and had that 1-800 number established for a community so everyone had that one number to call versus that? And I'll let you answer and ask my second question.
Mr. Chair, no, we don't think that the creation of centralized intake is driving the increase in reports. Before we got everybody into Anchorage, we did have 800 numbers in each of our five geographic regions that were well advertised, and then at some point we dropped that down to one singular number statewide. But we do not think that's a huge driver, no.
And second, as you're going into your next slide for tribal compact, Child Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Compact, I just sort of come to me that this is more of a do you feel this is more of a way to, I don't say privatize state government, but letting those local entities that sort of do this or have a little bit more compact, do you feel that this is more of a way to sort of privatize some of the functions of OCS?
I don't see it in the same light as privatization. I could see how people might view it that. I mean, I view it as a government-to-government relationship. I mean, these tribal organizations and tribes already have the inherent authority to provide these services, and in many cases they are providing child welfare services, not exactly the same as we are, but many are operating their own tribal foster care programs and helping families who are in distress before they make it to the, make their, you know, before they become our on our radar. So really this is an opportunity for those to grow, and for those that haven't been doing a lot of child welfare work to increase their authority to do some of that. It's not exactly the same as privatization because it is really a government-to-government thing. But in the long run, we hope that it will improve services to children and families and eventually potentially have cost savings for the state of Alaska. It's not necessarily going to be cost savings up front. We're not asking for any more money to do this. We're going to use the funds we have. But over time, if we can get those services delivered where the families are, by people who are also in the same communities and where they might be responsive, I think we certainly could see cost savings.
And then we're also coming short on time. So
yep. So I'll skip right ahead.
Oh, Senator Von Imhoff.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. Yeah, so number 11, when I'm putting together slide, I think it was slide 6 that you talked about, just your different, let's see here, the data, your review, and so you talked about highest strengths and weakness and lowest strengths and so forth. With the Child Welfare Compact, which I think is a good move, and I'm really excited to see how that plays out over time, who will be ultimately accountable then for the data successes and failures that you described in slide 6 regarding child placement with these child welfare compact agreements? I'm assuming then, as more and more tribal compact agreements are in existence and they take more and more responsibility, will they also be more and more accountable for ultimately the reports and kind of wrap up to OCS as a whole?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I think initially in the first few years, they're really going to be accountable to the state of Alaska because they're going to have to demonstrate that they're doing the services we would have otherwise had to do, and they're doing them in a quality way that it meets the benchmarks for things that are required by state law or federal law. Long term, the goal is that the tribes will also access federal funding, so they'll get their own federal funding agreements where they can draw down the federal share that can help pay for foster care services and have a portion of the state funds. This thing is giving me grief today. And have a portion of the state funds where they operate more autonomously their own programs. And under that scenario, they would be accountable to the feds and potentially to the state, but primarily to the feds for the operation of those programs. But going forward with some of the smaller services that could have significant will be significant in changing the trajectory for some of our families that we talked about when I was here last around helping to find relatives, helping to do assessments of relatives' homes so we can immediately place a child. Those things will be accountable to us, and we'll be monitoring them. They'll be providing us data, providing us reports about that work. Long term, if they actually get their own federal 4E agreements, they will have the same sort of accountability to the federal government as we do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I think I'm going to skip. I put the slide in before I start on the CRP slides because I wasn't sure if everybody was aware that in addition to the Citizens Review Panel, we see all of these other entities that are on the slide have some broad oversight kind of authority to OCS in different ways. Of course, you have the Federal Administration for Children and Families who, through the Child and Family Services Review and the Title IV audits that they do routinely, that's very clear, and they give us lots of guidance. There's the legislative audits. The Alaska court system certainly influences and helps to point at areas where the system's not working. We have the Facing Foster Care in Alaska Youth and Alumni that take a big role in helping to shape policy. If they see gaps, working with us to bridge those gaps. There's also the Alaska State Ombudsman that, typically, when they see trends, when they receive a number of complaints, they're making recommendations to us and suggestions for how to improve. We also have the Children's Justice Task Force that pursue policy, legislative policy themselves, but they also provide recommendations to us for improvements. The Resource Family Advisory Board is a group of foster families, and they also work with us on system improvements. And then you have the Citizens Review Panel. All of them, of course, are different in nature of what their purpose is and how they were developed. But I put that up there just as an example of all of the inputs that the Office of Children's Services is getting from so many places. And sometimes their recommendations and their ideas and their priorities align, which is helpful to us, and sometimes they don't. And so it is challenging to try to be as responsive as we can to really look at those recommendations and see what we can what we agree with and what we might follow through with, and ones that we just don't make too much sense. That being said, the Citizens Review Panel is an important organization in the state of Alaska, and we appreciate the work that they do. I'm just going to touch quickly over what those recommendations were that you heard from Dr. Vandapalli last year and make a few remarks myself. And then if there's any questions, I'm happy to entertain them. The first recommendation from the 2017 report was that we assign CRP a significant role in implementing priority areas of the Transforming Child Welfare Outcomes for Alaska Native Children. I think that we are doing this by way of their significant participation in our community engagement work group. We have six strategic priorities, and each of those priorities has a working group that's looking at the various strategies that were developed within each of those. And the CRP is heavily involved in that and really looking at how that can be done in sort of the participatory evaluation format. And they're looking at doing targeted town halls and how to survey people in, Alaska as a whole, targeted folks in Alaska, but then just average citizens of how we can get input using surveys. So Dr. Vandapalli and one of my staff, Travis Erickson, head that committee up and are working very closely on that with other community partners. The second recommendation was to speed up the process and implement the new tracking system and for grievances by December 2017. We have implemented a new tracking system. It's a fairly simple database for tracking grievances, but we think it will work. We had previously identified another method that we thought would be better that did not pan out, but we are in fact tracking the grievances. We can track the grievances to the case, and we are working, which will really speak to the third slide here, I think, to also establish that connection between a case file and any related grievances in order to also protect workers' identity. So one of the things that we want to be able to do is when a worker opens up a case, say they might be a new worker, they don't know anything about the participants in the case or the history, that they should be able to see an activity note that maybe identifies for them that, hey, there was five grievances filed by five family members. This was a really hot issue, and you know, there was lots of conversation, and they can sort of see what the takeaway is so they don't sort of step into a landmine or otherwise open a door that's already, you know, had a lot of work going to it. We don't have that capability quite yet in terms of the activity note, but we are working on it. With the database that we have that we're tracking, we are working on deciding what is the aggregate data that we will be putting on the website and how we'll structure it. But we can do the aggregate data, and our plan is to post that on the website in a easy-to-find location for those that would be interested. And that's something we'll be probably following back up with Dr. Van der Poly to see if he has any suggestions on that. So we're close to that being 100% done. Recommendation 5 was around OCS, recommendation for OCS to work with the CRP as a robust mechanism for public participation and help improve public awareness. As noted in my response to recommendation 1, OCS is fully engaged and eager to help CRP's ability to effectively dialogue with the public and increase awareness. I think potentially with the legislation that's pending, that could provide opportunity for this to improve there. We'll be interested to see where that comes out. But they are actively participating, and we meet monthly with them to talk about their efforts and how we can work together. Again, 6 is also about just the working relationship, and specifically working under a participatory evaluation framework, which is a new term that I've come to understand with Dr. Van der Poly's tutelage. But we agree that that framework makes sense and that it could provide a way for more meaningful dialogue and change. So we look forward to that endeavor and the continued partnership with them on that road. All right. Thank you.
Jeff, can we have members' questions? I do have a question. Part of the audit that was referenced, we're going through, talked about a training period for OCS was too short for the caseworkers and the heavy casework, and to prepare them for their heavier caseloads after the 2 to 3 weeks of training. And I know we're going to touch upon this here in a future bill upon training and workforce related issues, but has the department looked at coming up with a strategic plan to address more of a long-term goals? I know that Department of Public Safety just came out with a retention and workforce plan. Is the department looking to develop something like that as more as a hard, steady, fast sort of goal instead of saying, you know, this year we're going to look at university retention, this year we're going to look at sort of the training aspects, or is there a document or something that we can develop or something that you already have in the works or have published?
Mr. Chair, we don't have in one singular place a comprehensive document that covers all of those issues. We do, as a part of our five-year plan that we have to submit to the feds, we talk about workforce challenges and some of the things we're doing. My hope, and I've said this to our partners at UAA, is that through the work with them, I would like to create a comprehensive plan that would speak to not only the work where they can particularly help us, but we'd also embed some of the internal things as a division as well as a department that we can do, so we can create this document with some goals, short-term and long-term. I mean, it's probably like a 10-year strategic plan to really change what's happening with the workforce, but it's something that if I'm gone tomorrow, somebody else can pick up and see the roadmap, use it, tweak it, however they want, but at least there's a roadmap and they know what's been happening. Right now, we do not have that kind of document in place, but my hope is that we will get one.
Okay. Thank you, and I can Senator Giesel.
You know, I just wanted to add something, Mr. Chairman. I've actually inquired of the University of Alaska what they're doing to meet the need for social workers, and I haven't gotten a reply back, but I am interested because this is certainly something OCS needs, that workforce, and I'm interested in what innovations the university is coming up with.
We are wishing you the best. We want to see the department succeed, as you know, you play a vital role. And you know, one of the roles I know that a citizens review panel can do is the advocacy role. And you know, we OCS, the department, doesn't have a way to have sort of soft contacts with folks. You know, you go in because there's a problem, and there's really a hard opportunity. There's not an opportunity to show the value of what your department can do. And so I know that that was part of the CRP recommendation, sort of that integration of how they can advocate on behalf of OCS, since that's also part of their function and core mission as well. Mm-hmm. So I just want to say thank you for presenting, and I'm sure we'll see you in a couple more weeks for another bill.
Okay, thank you.
Any other final questions for comments on this presentation? All right, thank you. We'll take our brief at ease. Go back on the record. Finally, last business of today's committee is we'll return to Senate Bill 169, Medicaid Behavioral Health Coverage, by Senator DeGiesel. We adopted the CS and heard from the bill's sponsor, took public testimony on March 5th, and that CS we adopted is before you. Here in the audience today to answer a couple of additional questions is Director Randall Burns from the Division of Behavioral Health is here, and on phone we have Rick Holt, I can't speak today. Calcote. All right, thank you. The mental health clinician 3 from the Division of Behavioral Health is on by phone. Are there any further questions from the bill sponsor today? Any amendments?
Yes.
Senator Begich.
Mr. Chairman, based on the conversation last time and John Cesata's comments, we had a general discussion, and I went ahead and, based on that discussion and talking to the bill sponsor, went ahead and asked for legislatively able to draft up language that would include physicians, and they've come back with what I'm offering is amendment, I guess it's number one, it doesn't have a number on it, but it would be amendment number one. So I'd like to move amendment number one to for CSSB 169 draft version J.
Okay. And I'll object for discussion.
So what this amendment would do would simply delete the word psychiatrist, put in physician, and the reason why was in the attached memo that went around, and which I shared with everyone, and that memo indicates that psychiatrist is under the definition of physician, and I think this is more imperative given the comments in the email from the Senator Giesel, which pointed out that there were actually fewer people than we thought that were potentially able to we had fewer psychiatrists than we thought that were eligible, but I think she wants to speak to that, and so I won't speak for her.
Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, you know, in the interim between our last meeting, I accessed an Arctic Mental Health Coalition report, and in it the report actually identified that there were 85 psychiatrists in the entire state of Alaska. This was based on 2015 to 16 primary care needs assessment. So I did update that number, and I believe I sent that report around to committee members. So then I went online and looked at clinical psychologists. It looks like there are about 140 of those. Clinical social workers, 780. That's based on their board audit that was just completed this year. And marital and family therapists, it looks like there's about 80, but that was a manual count based on the licensing website. So we have close to 1,000 more clinicians that could work under supervision of either the physician, which of course is a very much larger number than 85, or an advanced nurse practitioner clinic, especially certified in psychiatric mental health. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other comments, questions? Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Although we have a zero fiscal note, the reality of it is I walked through how behavioral health is charged to Medicaid with a provider the other day, and what I can tell you is that the savings to the state are significant, potentially significant, with the expanded supervision that we're providing in this bill. So it's not an easy number to land upon, but I can tell you that it will be in the millions of dollars. So I support the zero fiscal note indeterminate, just gives it another committee of referral, which I don't think is necessary for this simple bill, but I appreciate the bill and support it very much.
And I have a quick question for Director Burns, if you could come in. Just want to put your name and yourself on the record.
Excuse me, for the record, my name is Randall Burns. I'm the director of the Division of Behavioral Health.
Thank you, Director Burns. For this term physician, do you see any potential holdups or problems or any issues the department may have with this term physicians or psychiatrists? And because we're just doing the supervision, so it doesn't change sort of the licensing requirements for individuals to go through. It's just a term change, correct?
Mr. Chairman, we actually don't have any comments on the decision to strike psychiatrists and replace it with physician. We do, however, have to unfortunately point out to the committee that in terms of clinic services, CMS has a rule and it limits who can supervise clinic services to a physician or a dentist, if it's a dental practice. So that is a correction that you might want to talk about. However, I would point out that advanced practice registered nurses can already practice and do bill Medicaid directly and have that capability. So if we're just talking about clinic services, we would suggest that it be limited to physicians, if that's the term that you all adopt.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for Director Burns? Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the bill sponsor or the maker of the motion? All right. I'll go ahead and remove my objection if there's no other objection. Amendment passes. Is there a motion to Amendment 1 passes. Is there a motion to move this bill from committee? Senator Von Imhoff?
Thank you. I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 169, Health and Social Services, as amended from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
All right. Any objection? Hearing or seeing none, the CS for Senate Bill 169 with as amended passes committee. We'll take an ID to sign the document. That concludes our business today for Senate Hess. Is there any committee closing comments from committee members? All right. Seeing and hearing none, just a reminder, we will not have committee this Friday, and our next committee meeting is Monday, where we believe we'll hear an overview from the Department of Behavioral Health. With that, we're adjourned at 2:58 p.m.